You will have noticed by now the profiles of three new members who are joining the church today. We like for those new members to station themselves somewhere about the middle of our reception room, fellowship hall. And I see that Michaeline Davidson is properly ensconced at the end of a pew row so she can make a hasty exit and get down there ahead of us, but I neglected to tell Duane and Debbie Green to do the same thing, and they're up in the balcony partially trapped. So Duane and Debbie, when we begin to sing our choral benediction, please flee away and beat us down to Fellowship Hall. I'm sorry I forgot to tell you sooner. I once heard a California physician do a half-serious takeoff on the old familiar saying, if I had my life to live over. He spoke of how he would limber up, not take so many things seriously, climb more mountains, swim more rivers, watch more sunsets. He said, I've been one of those people who never go anywhere without a thermometer, a hot water bottle, a gargle, a raincoat, and a parachute. If I had to do it over again, I would go places and do things and travel lighter. I would play hooky more. I wouldn't make such good grades except by accident. I would ride on more merry-go-rounds. I'd pick more daisies. While the good doctor counted on us to recognize the humorous exaggeration, he was not joking in his belief that we get too solemn, take ourselves too seriously, get too busy to do all sorts of things we'd really like to do until it's too late to do them. There's a great deal of good sense in what he says, including the remark that one should make good grades only by accident. That is, good grades should happen because you are aiming at knowledge, at learning things, and not because you're aiming directly at grades. And grown-ups do need to be a little silly and crazy at times and watch more sunsets and not lose today by living so many years ahead of it. My doctor friend had been a high achiever all his life, had worked hard to hone his professional skills, and when I teased him by saying that despite his romantic musings, he would probably live his life over again just about the same way he had lived it the first time, he laughed and agreed with me. But I liked the touch of nostalgia in him, and the rueful sense that in his diligence and discipline, he had missed some good things. But what his playful approach really makes me think of this morning is the more somber mood in which all of us at times consider the changes we would make if we had a second chance at life, especially when we had messed things up before with short tempers or loose tongues or weak wills. It's an interesting speculation, this romantic dreaming that if we could only live our lives over again, they would turn out so much better. Because it raises one of the most important questions we can ask about the relationship between character and events. In other words, has my life been less than I wanted it to be because of accident or the ill will of others? Or has it been less because of me, because of what I am? If I got a second chance and went around again, would it really be so different after all, unless somehow I were changed myself. The Bible, as any good student of it could guess, looks at both sides of that question. One of the old Jewish prophets by the name of Jeremiah doubted very much that certain people he knew would do any better. After all, he asks, can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? He obviously felt that character is destiny and that there was little chance some of his contemporaries could ever be any different. But not everybody who appears in the biblical story felt that way. John the Baptist thought people could change and told them in a voice of thunder that they had better. And Christ believed in a second chance, although he spoke of it more gently. You have to change, he said, and become like little children in order to enter the kingdom of heaven, a state of existence many of us like to call the kingdom of right relationships. A character change described in John's gospel as a kind of new birth. It can be uncomfortable to hear such talk because we learn so well to justify ourselves by blaming others or blaming circumstances, almost anything to avoid having to confess, it's not something else. It's me, O Lord. I'm the problem. It's hard enough to whisper that in private, infinitely harder to confess a character flaw in public, especially if you are someone of great prominence. I've never forgotten the impact of a luncheon speech I heard one day during my years in St. Louis. A Monsanto executive had invited me to hear Martin Niemöller, the famous German Lutheran minister, who, although it took him a while, finally risked his life in opposing Hitler's Nazi party. In 1933, he told us, when the communists were imprisoned, I did not lift my voice. I did not say to my congregation, be on your guard. There is something wrong happening here. And when the feeble-minded were murdered, I said to myself, am I to be the guardian of the feeble-minded? I could not even claim that I was ignorant of the persecution of the Jews, but I did nothing. I only started speaking out when the faith of the church was persecuted. He looked at us for a long, solemn moment and said, for this neglect, I am greatly to blame. I have sinned. But if Pastor Niemöller had lived those same Nazi years over again without the benefit of hindsight, would he act any differently? Jeremiah thought not in his moment of anger, and would probably say that our characters are largely fixed, that we are what we are, and that even if we cycled back through life again, we'd make the same mistakes. Jesus, on the other hand, believed in the possibility of change, new beginnings, fresh starts. So is character fixed or flexible? I thought you might enjoy hearing how a Scotch playwright by the name of J.M. Barrie wrestled with this eminently Christian problem. Barrie's name may not ring a bell as the author of an amusing play about British social life called The Admirable Crichton, but you'll feel a little closer to him to learn that he wrote Peter Pan, which everybody knows, either from having read the play or having seen Mary Martin fly across the stage on Broadway, or in a movie, or on television, or if by some miracle you missed all that, then Peter Pan is familiar because he smiles from 100,000 peanut butter jars, all decked out in a pointed green cap and red freckles. So we owe that familiar character to J.M. Barrie. But he wrote another play, which I like better than either of the ones just mentioned, a play called Dear Brutus, a title stolen from a couple of lines in Shakespeare, which I'd like to save until later because they so perfectly sum up what Barrie wants us to believe about life. Barrie liked to get at reality by writing fantasy, and that's how Dear Brutus works. When the curtain goes up, we discover that a group of people have gathered in a big house occupied by a strange little man whose name is Lob. If we know a little English folklore, we catch on right away that this is going to be an unusual play, because Lob is one of the names given to Puck, that mischievous sprite who also shows up in A Midsummer Night's Dream. In fact, the very next thing we learn is that our play is taking place on Midsummer's Eve, June the 23rd, when, according to ancient superstition, all sorts of strange things may happen to people. When we first meet the house guests, the women are off by themselves, and they have cooked up a scheme to embarrass the butler of the place, whose name is Matey, and who has already managed to steal rings from three of them. He thinks they don't know this. They ask him to take a telegram for them to the post office, but they insist that he read the message aloud before he goes. When he does, it says, "To police station. Send officer first thing in the morning to arrest Matey, butler, for theft of rings." He's embarrassed, of course, quickly takes the rings out of his pocket, returns them, and hopes the case is closed. But they insist that as part of the price of their forgiveness, he has to tell them what it is they all have in common, since the owner of the house, Lob, has hinted that this is why they were all invited on this particular night. Matey begs the women not to make him tell what Lob is up to, and then he pleads his own case by arguing that all our lives are determined by certain turnings, little tricks of fate, and that with a few breaks, things would have worked out better for him, and he would not now be a thief. He really believes this. So we know what Matey represents, the almost universal human tendency to blame circumstance rather than character for what we do. If I had only taken the clerkship that was offered me once, Matey says, I'd be the most honest man alive today. Now please keep that offer of a clerkship in mind for a few minutes. Matey warns the women not to go into a certain nearby forest which has magical qualities he can only hint at. And just at this moment, the men come in from another room, and we discover that they, too, think their lives would have been quite different if only circumstances had been different. And now we know that this is what it is that all the guests have in common. the conviction that fate is to blame for their failures. One of them would have written a book. If only he had been poor enough to feel compelled to write it. Another guest, Mr. Purdy, is a philanderer who blames first one thing and then another for his shallow, selfish flitting from one woman to another. And there is Mr. Dearth, who was once a promising artist, but who began to drink and lose his talent when he felt that his wife had lost faith in him. And there is his wife, who blames everything bad in her character on having had the misfortune to marry him. He's the man in the play who happens to draw back a curtain at one of the windows, look out at the garden, and then let the curtain fall back like someone who has just gotten a very bad shock. He is so solemn and serious when he turns back to the others that even his wife is impressed. He insists on knowing what is in that garden, which before his very eyes had suddenly turned into a forest. And the little man, Lob, is forced to tell all of them that it is a magical wood, that to go into it is to find what everybody longs for, the miracle of a second chance with life. So, of course, they all go into it, in one way or another, including Matey, who has been thrown out of the house by his master. When we meet the characters again in Act 2, they're all walking around in the magic wood. The sticky-fingered butler, Matey, has already gotten his second chance. He is now extremely wealthy, although his manners and his language have not changed. And we discover that although he did take that clerkship in this second time around and is now driving a Rolls Royce, he is still a thief. Only now, instead of stealing small personal items like rings, he is stealing from huge corporations and national banks. In other words, into a changed set of circumstances, he has taken his own unchanged character. And so nothing is really different. As one of the characters puts it, it's not fate. Fate is something outside us. What really plays the Dickens with us is something in ourselves, something that makes us go on doing the same sort of fool things, however many chances we get. And sure enough, the philanderer, Mr. Purdy, is also at it again, chasing a different woman this time, but using the same tricks and the same talk and feeling just as sorry for himself as before. One has the sense that he may be doomed to be this kind of man forever, no matter in what life he finds himself. The same is true of most of the others. But the playwright is too much of a romantic himself not to make a little good news out of this, which is to say that the gospel is in this play, or I would not be using it this morning. Dearth, the man who once had hope as a painter, is now painting. And with him is the daughter he never had, but always wanted, and he is sublimely happy. His wife, who was so sure before she went into the woods that things were bad for her because she chose poorly in marriage, now chooses wrong again. And when she returns to the house, is in far worse shape than when we first met her. But she and her husband Both recognize now their own responsibility for their failures, and they are the one pair for whom the playwright seems to have a real glimmer of hope. One of the critical Christian themes held up in this play is the importance of self-knowledge and the willingness to admit that the mistakes we make in life are more likely to come from flaws in our personalities than from accidents of fate. The play is realistic enough to know that most of us would be the same basic people in the magical wood that we were in real life, but it's also hopeful enough to think that some of us may change. Of the revelations in that magical wood, one character asks, "Is there ever any permanent effect?" Once in a while, Lob admits, and in that quiet statement shines the hope which playwright Barry could never quite abandon and which Jesus made the centerpiece of his gospel, that it is possible to start over and make life different. But it only happens when, instead of shifting the blame, we find the courage to say the words from which Barry took his title and his theme, the words I promised you would hear at the end. Two men, Cassius and Brutus, in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, still another play, are talking about Caesar himself, a man inferior in many ways to themselves, but to whom they are now required, by virtue of his position, to bow down and worship as if he were a god. Cassius especially doesn't like this, would like to change things. He challenges his friend to create his own destiny. After all, he says, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings." Not in our stars, but in ourselves. Taking the blame, it may be the toughest confession in the world to make, but if getting a second chance is ever to make any difference, it's the first step. And I hope you've recognized it by now, that when you decided to come to this place today, when you decide to come on any Sunday morning, you enter the magical forest of the second chance. The rest of us, stumbling around hopefully in that wood, wish you the best of luck.